Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Thank you all for coming. We're really thrilled to be here together. Thank you to all those folks joining us via the live stream. I want to welcome everyone on behalf of the Overseas-Based Realignment and Closure Coalition to the official launch of the coalition and to the launch of the coalition's letter to the Trump administration and Congress arguing for the closure of wasteful, damaging, and unneeded U.S. military bases abroad. I should say my name is David Vine. For those who don't know me, I'm a professor of anthropology at American University here in Washington, D.C. Everyone in the room should have a copy of the letter that we are sending to the Trump administration and Congress. If you're joining us online and don't have a copy of the letter, you can find it at our website, which is www.overseasbases.net. www.overseasbases.net. The coalition, or OBRAC, as we like to call it, has been working together steadily since the spring, and I'm excited that we have a chance to share our work and encourage others to join our coalition. In fact, I've been working on overseas bases for 17 years, and I think I've been wanting to be part of a coalition like this that spans the political spectrum for about that long. Our coalition and the 40 expert signatories to our letter include Republicans, Democrats, Libertarians, Greens, Independents. They include a retired Army general and other retired military officers, and Code Pink and other peace advocates, a former GOP member of Congress, and Noam Chomsky, Clinton, Reagan, and George W. Bush administration officials, and academic and think tank analysts with diverse political backgrounds. OBRAC is actually so diverse that at times it feels like we're in one of those jokes where a priest or rabbi and an imam walk into a bar, except in our case it's the Koch Foundation, Code Pink, and the Cato Institute walk into a bar. It does. We actually haven't had any of our meetings in a bar, but maybe something for the future. And we can work on a joke. Before I finish a brief introduction, let me say some quick thanks, though. I thank all of you for joining us both in person and via live stream. Thank you to our four really distinguished speakers, Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, Dr. Catherine Lutz, Christine Ahn, and John Glazer. For those here in the room, both Dr. Catherine Lutz and Christine Ahn will be joining us remotely via the live stream. Thank you also to all the people and organizations who've been involved in OBRAC for all our hard work together in organizing the letter in today's event. And I want to call out and shout out especially Kate Kieser, Alan Vogel, Andrew Basevich, Barry Klein, Catherine Lutz, Cynthia Enlow, David Swanson, John Pfeffer, John Glazer, John Lindsay Poland, Joseph Gerson, Leah Bulger, Michelle Newby, Miriam Pemberton, Phyllis Bennis, William Ruger, Lawrence Wilkerson, and Bill Hartung, among others who've helped in numerous ways. And apologies to anyone who I may have inadvertently overlooked. Thank you also to the Office of Senator Sheldon Whitehouse, and especially to Alexandra Fox and Sam Goodstein for their help in reserving this room and making the meeting possible. I'm going to share some more details in a moment about OBRAC and the OBRAC letter, and then before turning things over to comments from our speakers, after which we'll have time for Q&A. If you're joining us via live stream, you can ask a question by sending a message with the teleconference's chat feature. So please do feel free, and I'll try to monitor those as carefully as possible. There's some people who tell you that the right and left can't agree on anything these days. The Overseas-Based Realignment and Closure Coalition has shown that people on the right, left, and at many other places on the political spectrum can agree on not just one thing, but on at least nine things. OBRAC has shown that in an era of bitter divisions between right and left, consensus is growing around a long overlooked but crucial part of how the United States engages with the world, the nearly 75-year-old Cold War-era strategy maintaining some 800 military bases in around 80 foreign countries and territories outside the 50 states in Washington, D.C. system of bases includes 194 base sites in Germany, 121 in Japan, 83 in South Korea, 44 in Italy. Others can be found in places including Aruba, Bahrain, Cuba, Djibouti, Ethiopia, Honduras, Iraq, Jordan, Kenya, Liberia, the Marshall Islands, Norway, Oman, the Philippines, Qatar, Romania, Saudi Arabia, Tunisia, United Kingdom, and Wake Island, just to name a few. A few other nations have a very small number of foreign bases among them, but with about 800 US bases abroad, the United States possesses 90 to 95% of the world's foreign military bases. OBRAC and the letter we're releasing today reflect growing agreement among military experts across the ideological spectrum that reducing this excessive and outdated US military footprint could counterintuitively make the country safer while saving billions, literally billions of dollars a year. The signatories to the OBRAC letter have different ideas about how many bases to close, which bases to close first, and how to go about closing them. But we find broad agreement with the following 9 reasons to begin closing foreign bases and improve national and international security in the process. I'll very briefly outline the 9 points of consensus, and we're happy to discuss any of the points of consensus in more detail in the Q&A. First, overseas bases are much, much more expensive than comparable domestic bases, even when a host country pays for some of the costs. Overseas bases cost taxpayers more than $50 billion a year, and more than $150 billion a year if you include the costs of US troops overseas. And I point you to our fact sheets, which not only has facts along these lines, but also careful citations documenting all the facts. And I think when thinking about the cost, the $50 billion alone, we should think about the opportunity costs. We should think about our crumbling domestic civilian infrastructure, our schools, our hospitals, our homelessness, our debt. Second, overseas bases entangle the US in wars. They make war more likely, and they enable a reckless interventionist foreign policy. At least 23 times, US bases have been used to launch wars of choice or military interventions in 14 countries in the greater Middle East alone since 1980, including in the catastrophic cases of Yemen, finally in the news, Iraq, and Afghanistan. Third, overseas bases are now largely obsolete thanks to technological developments. Today, the US can deploy rapid response forces fast enough to be based in continental United States in almost all, if not all, cases. Fourth, and moving more quickly, overseas bases increase military tension with powers including Russia and China, which are encircled by hundreds of US bases. Fifth, overseas bases support at least 40 dictators and repressive, undemocratic regimes that frequently host US bases. Sixth, overseas bases cause blowback, including terrorist attacks, radicalization, and anti-American propaganda. Seventh, overseas bases damage the environment in a vast array of ways. Eighth, overseas bases damage the United States' international reputation and generate protests almost everywhere, like the decades of protests seen in Okinawa. Ninth, overseas bases cause harm to US military personnel deployed abroad and to their families. Now, in terms of beginning to close some of the 800 bases abroad, it's important to note that compared to closing domestic bases, a process that many of you are probably familiar with, BRAC, Congress does not need to be involved in overseas base closures. Presidents George H.W. Bush, Bill Clinton, and George W. Bush closed hundreds of bases in Europe and Asia. They should have gone even farther, and the Trump administration can now do the same. This would mean bringing home thousands of military personnel and family members to bases in the United States, where there is considerable excess capacity and where their paychecks would contribute to the domestic economy. That is beyond saving money on the bases themselves, members of Congress have a strong economic incentive to want to bring these troops home to their districts and states. Meanwhile, it's of course important to know that local movements around the world, places like Okinawa and far beyond, are demanding base closures or a significantly reduced U.S. military presence. Importantly, as some of our speakers will discuss in just a moment, there are far more effective military and diplomatic alternatives to protecting national security and maintaining nearly 1,000 overseas bases at a cost of tens of billions of dollars every year. Now, let me briefly introduce our speakers who represent some of the breadth of our transpartisan coalition and the people who have signed our letter, the 40 experts on overseas bases who signed the letter. Although I should quickly note that there are yet more individuals who would have liked to have signed our letter but couldn't because their organizations don't allow signing on to set public letters, or because in a few cases, people agreed with the vast majority of our points of consensus, but in one or two cases didn't agree but are still willing to work with us. So, our esteemed speakers. Christine Ahn is the founder and international coordinator of Women Cross DMZ, the global movement of women mobilizing to end the Korean War. Ahn is the co-founder of the Korea Policy Institute, Global Campaign to Save Jeju Island, National Campaign to End the Korean War. Ahn is the former senior policy analyst at the Global Fund for Women, has worked with the Oakland Institute and Nautilus Institute for Security and Sustainable Development, among others. She's the author of The Revolution Will Not Be Funded and the co-producer of Fashion Resistance to Militarism. John Glazer, to my right, is director of foreign policy studies at the Cato Institute. His research interests include grand strategy, basing posture, U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East, and the rise of China, among other topics. Glazer is the author of an important study on overseas bases, which those in the room can find at the back. Withdrawing from overseas bases by a forward-deployed military posture is unnecessary, outdated, and dangerous. Glazer has been a guest on many television and radio programs. He's written for the New York Times, the Washington Post, LA Times, among others. Dr. Catherine Lutz, who you'll see in a moment by the live stream, is Thomas J. Watson, Jr., family professor of anthropology and international studies at the Watson Institute for International Studies at Brown University. Lutz is the author of numerous books on the U.S. military and its bases and personnel, including The Bases of Empire, The Global Struggle Against U.S. Military Posts, Homefront, a Military City in the American 20th Century, and Breaking Ranks. Dr. Lutz also co-directs the Cost of War Project at Brown University. Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, also to my right, is Distinguished Adjunct Professor of Government and Public Policy at the College of William and Mary. Colonel Wilkerson previously worked as Secretary of State Colin Powell's Chief of Staff and Associate Director of the State Department's Policy Planning Staff under Ambassador Richard Haass. Colonel Wilkerson served 31 years in the U.S. Army. During that time, he was a member of the faculty of the U.S. Naval War College, special assistant to General Powell when Powell was chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and director of the U.S. Marine Corps War College. And I should just mention about myself, in addition to being a professor at American University, I've written two books that I hope are relevant to the subject today, Base Nation, How U.S. Military Bases Abroad Harm America and the World, and Island of Shame, Secret History of the U.S. Military Base on Diego Garcia. Without further ado, let me turn things over to John Glazer. So live stream folks can see that.
Well, thank you, David, very much. David has led this entire process. It's been really fun to watch him to lead it, and I didn't know, or I forgot, that he spent 17 years on this stuff, and so, but that clearly shows his passion for the issue. A lot of the things he mentioned, a lot of the things, the points of consensus on the open letter, a lot of the material that you can find in the back, I mean, there are lots of solid arguments against overseas bases. They cost too much, they entangle us in wars, you know, they cause resentment and blowback and this kind of stuff. And you can read up on all of those types of arguments back there. But it's also valuable to take a step back and look at it kind of more from a bird's eye view. And I'm going to suggest that that's sort of worthwhile to do just for our understanding. So, you know, when the Cold War ended, our main geopolitical adversary just disappeared. That's another way of saying we got extremely more safe than we were. And yet, our behavior in the post-Cold War era has been one of hyperactivity in terms of foreign policy. Really, really active and interventionist to an absurd extent. So in the past 30 years since the end of the Cold War, we spent about $15 trillion on our military. It's an unfathomable sum of money that far exceeds what any other country in the world has spent. Since 1990, we have engaged in more individual military interventions than we had in the preceding 190 years of our existence as a nation. It's an extreme amount of hyperactivity. 46% of Americans have lived the majority of their lives with the United States in a state of war. 21% have lived their entire lives like this. Now, you can also think of the incredible ease with which the executive branch of this country gets to deploy U.S. military force abroad. I mean, how many Americans are aware of the fact that we've been routinely bombing Somalia for more than 3 years? It's hard to know that because we're bombing so many countries. We've got active military hostilities in, I mean, the counts differ because the government isn't always honest with you, but the counts anywhere from 8 to 14 countries were engaged in active hostilities. So not all of these things are because we have a massive overseas military presence, but our overseas military presence facilitates and enables this kind of hyperactivism. And, you know, I think back to the scholar and nuclear strategist Bernard Brody, who long ago made the point that one way of keeping people out of trouble is to deny them the means for getting into it. And if you can imagine a situation where we had a Congress that embraced its constitutional responsibilities to check the president's war powers, we could close down some of these bases and make it much harder for us to willy-nilly intervene in every nook and cranny of the planet. So overseas bases are not about protecting the United States. No overseas base protects you. Overseas bases are kind of like an insurance policy on stability abroad. They're supposed to deter adversaries in places far, far away from our shores. Deter Russia from causing trouble in Eastern Europe, deter China from causing trouble in the South China Sea. It doesn't tend to work because those countries get fear and they tend to act out against our attempts to contain them. But in any case, overseas bases are not about national defense per se. And that's important because the role of the military in our society is supposed to protect our country. And our overseas bases don't actually do that. They're simply a physical manifestation of our grand strategy. Some people call this grand strategy primacy, liberal hegemony, deep engagement. There's lots of wonky names for it. But essentially, it's this idea that the United States needs to play the role of global policeman. We need to maintain global peace and stability or cause a lot of instability and war, which is what we tend to do with these bases. And so that's really important, that they're just a reflection of our current grand strategy. Now, often they're just there to bolster the credibility of our security commitments. I mean, the United States is unique in the world. We're the only country in the world with more than 60 nations that were obligated by treaty to go and defend. And then we have a dozen or more tacit agreements with non-treaty allies that we will defend. And so that requires a lot of overseas basing if you want to make those threats credible. But fundamentally, we will not see a shift away from this policy of forward deployment until we see a shift in our strategy. Until we get away from this conception of the U.S. role in the world that says we need to be globally engaged and militarily active in every region. So I'll stop there and wait for Q&A and go on to the next speaker. Thanks.
We will thankfully now break up this boys' club in the room with Dr. Catherine Lutz.
Take us away, Kathy.
Okay, great. Hi, everyone. Very grateful to David Vine and the rest of the group for getting us this far with, again, an amazing document that represents the kind of very unusual coalition building and idea building that around the question of how to make a safer world via the cutting back on U.S. military basing overseas. The reason I've signed the letter and the issue that I think we are trying to highlight is that these bases are often more harmful than beneficial, and in particular, they become in some cases, in many cases, targets rather than protected spaces. I think particularly of the island of Guam, where I've done research for many years, and where in the recent North Korean U.S. saber rattling, the people of Guam had to live for, as they have many times in the past, with a sense that they were about to be become a target because of those military assets on the island, with very little warning. Forward bases have that problem of being, again, often able to be attacked with little warning. In fact, during the Cold War, the sort of dark joke was that nobody knew where the island of Guam was except targeters in the Kremlin. And that's, I think, an indication of the kind of problem that's set up when we have places in so many places, which not only are targets, but often are provocative and create local arms races in the way that was just referenced in the previous speaker. I think the other thing that makes me very keen to see something like this really get taken up by the administration is the cost, the $50 billion annual cost to have bases overseas rather than domestically. And again, our eyes usually roll back in our heads as we try to figure out what this all means, millions, billions, trillions. But just to give you a sense, that $50 billion annually is equivalent to about half. Half of that $50 billion would be the annual budget of the FDA, the CDC, the Center for Disease Control, the National Science Foundation, and the WIC program. And then we'd still have millions to spare. So again, the opportunity costs are substantial. And again, the idea of a national security policy that focuses on simply military policy rather than understanding that a hollowed out domestic front is becomes less and less something that we can see as having been benefited by this security strategy. In addition, I think many times as again the previous speaker mentioned, the bases are seen in popular imagination and in the national security establishment as things which send a message. Bombs and bases send messages to our adversaries and deter, according to that popular belief. But whenever I hear that language of sending a message, I think of the importance of sending a message with diplomacy. Again, some of that $50 billion should be redirected to a more effective means of communication of our intentions and our national interests than through overseas basing. The State Department has really atrophied as, again, increasing numbers of dollars are spent on this interventionist foreign policy that the bases facilitate. So that's where I'll put my my thoughts out to you and look forward to questions.
Fantastic. Thank you, Kathy. And now we'll be joined by Christine Ahn, who is very nice to join us at the last minute.
Great, thank you.
Christine, hold on 1 second, sorry. Apologies, now you can go ahead.
Okay, great, thanks David for having me. I think it's plainly obvious why I signed on to the letter. I have a 6-year-old daughter, and I'm increasingly anxious about our future in terms of not just growing instability caused by climate change, but as the letter states, the out-of-control deficit and military spending. We just cannot afford to continue on this path, and has devastating consequences for our security here as Americans, but also on the lives of our friends and families around the world living near US bases. I've traveled extensively throughout South Korea and met with South Koreans impacted directly by the US military and the bases, whether it's women who have worked around the US camp towns and sex brothels, who were subjected to really horrific, gross human rights violations in terms of treatment. I've met with farmers, I've seen schools destroyed, community centers, homes, caused by the expansion of the largest US military base in the world, Camp Humphreys in Pyeongtaek. I've heard from South Korean civilian groups who are very concerned about the environmental impact, whether it's the hidden burial of Agent Orange all throughout South Korea. But one group recently submitted a FOIA request about the Yongsan military base, and they found that from 1990 to 2015, there were 84 reports of toxic environmental contamination near and at Yongsan base, which is in Seoul. So I'm here to give voice to those people who cannot speak directly to US lawmakers or to the American public. As someone who has long worked for peace on the Korean Peninsula, there hasn't been a more fitting moment to be having this conversation. Most Americans don't realize this, but 2018 has been a banner year for peace on the Korean Peninsula, where the threat of nuclear war has been eclipsed by the prospect of finally ending the 70-year Korean War. The two Korean leaders, South Korean President Moon Jae-in and North Korean Chairman Kim Jong-un, they've signed two historic agreements, the Panmunjom Declaration and the Pyongyang Declaration. They've set forth opening up a liaison office. So there's 24/7, 365 days a year, dialogue between the two governments. They've resumed family reunions, civil society engagements. They've demilitarized the border dividing Korea. Last week, we saw images that were tweeted virally of North and South Korean soldiers shaking hands at the DMZ. They've already begun to demine a portion of the DMZ. So this is happening. And as we also witnessed, Donald Trump met with Kim Jong-un. Clearly, there is a lot of work yet to be done between the US and North Korea. But in that Singapore statement, they committed to establishing new US DPRK relations in accordance with the desires of the people for peace and prosperity. So given the diplomatic breakthrough, the historic moment that we're in, this is the time now to be having this conversation. So thank you for allowing me to offer this point of view.
Thank you so much, especially for your joining us at the last minute. Now, let me turn things over to Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson.
Old man, get up. I come at this from a slightly different point of view than the speakers you've heard, although I identify with remarks they've made in most cases. And my perspective was shaped as one of the principal strategists for the Army for a long time, dealing with one of the principal areas we had to deal with, the Middle East, which I like to call Southwest Asia, which my friends Wang Yi and Choi Ting Kai and other Chinese diplomats appreciate, because it is Western Asia. The term Middle East is a bastardization of the British. There's nothing middle about it, it's part of Asia. When you look at it that way, and then you go back to the time that was seminal for me with both Colin Powell as chairman of the Joint Chiefs and otherwise as strategic planner in the Pacific, for example, you understand viscerally some of the points that have been made. For example, Osama bin Laden made no bones about why he conducted 9/11. He conducted 9/11 because we had defouled the holy sites in Saudi Arabia by putting U.S. ground troops there. Now, whether you agree with that or not is irrelevant. He felt that way, as did al-Qaeda, and Ayman al-Zawahiri, the brainchild of al-Qaeda and others. For 40 years, U.S. military and security policy and foreign policy followed that, said unequivocally, we will not put bases in the Middle East under no circumstances, because we understand the volatility of that region. We understand what might happen if we were to do that with 400 million Arabs, 70 million Persians, and so forth and so on. This is a very difficult region. We will do what we call at the time offshore balancing, which simply meant that Air Force assets, carrier battle groups, marine amphibious groups, and so forth in the region, mostly in the northern Indian Ocean, would, if we needed to apply military power, do just that and then leave. Never linger. Look at what we have today. The force laid down in the Middle East today is incomparable to anything we have ever done in any region since World War II. When Jim Mattis tells you that we've shifted to the Indo-Pacific region, he's smoking something really low grade. I read an article this morning from the New Yorker. It is potent, and I have to amend David's recitation of where we have bases. We now are building bases in Syria. And we have contractors in Syria providing hamburgers and Burger Kings. And we have airfields in Syria where jets take off. We built them. It's lucrative territory for the millions of dollars that are produced by contractors doing this for us. Give you an idea of how that has become so bloated. In the first Gulf War that I was at hand for as a military officer, we had about 7,500 contractors helping us in Iraq. In the second Gulf War, we had 200,000. When war becomes so profitable across the board, from Lockheed Martin, the world's largest defense contractor, and I call them merchant of death, which they are, to the smallest, are going to be there. And they're going to be making money off of this. And that's what's happening in Syria. This New Yorker article is beautiful because the guy goes up to one of the Marines and says, why are you here? And he says, I don't know. I'm just here, and I'm smoking a cigarette, and I'm eating a hamburger, and drinking a Coke, and everything's copacetic. That's what we're doing. That very thing is what is costing us in polls, for example. Half the world's identifying us as the greatest threat to their future, whether they're talking about their state, as in Pakistan, or they're talking about their children, as in most of Southwest Asia. They think the United States of America is the greatest threat to their future. And that number is growing, not decreasing. I did bring one thing with me. I want to read it to you. It's from the American Conservative magazine. And let me just say, I agree with David. This is an incredible issue. Just like the issue I worked on yesterday and the day before, the Yemen war, in Senate Special Resolution 54, where we brought together all manner of people. Thank you. That was a historic vote, and we're looking for the vote next week to even be more historic. Get us out of this brutal war that we are complicit in with the greatest state sponsor of terrorism in the world, Mike Pompeo. You are a liar. You hear him the other day talking about how Iran was this and Iran was that. Every description of Iran that he made applies in tenfold to Saudi Arabia. And not only that, we have a madman in charge of Saudi Arabia. Look at what he's done. He's brought the Turks, his greatest ideological enemy, into Qatar. Troops on Qatar soil now from Turkey. At one end, he's fouled his flank, and at the other end, he's fighting a war, brutally fighting a war, with food and humanitarian issues as his tools of that war. And he's losing. And we're with him. And a lot of that is facilitated by the base structure that we have now built in the Middle East. Look at what we've done from where I was in 1984, 85, 86, for example, and where we are today. Largest military bases in the world. Qatar, Al-Udeid Air Base, largest U.S. air facility in the world. Bahrain, largest fleet headquarters in the world. And we have troops all over Kuwait. We have troops in Oman. We now have troops in Syria, allegedly to stay until the Iranians leave. That means forever. We have troops, of course, in Afghanistan. We have troops in Iraq. We have troops all over the area, and we're not making friends. Let me tell you, we're not making friends. This is what this base structure does. The other aspect of it that I'm really concerned with is the one that's been brought up here, because when I started this process with Colin Powell at the end of the Cold War, when he was chair, the president had given us directions to close every single overseas base we did not need any longer. Well, the first thing we did when we looked at it was, holy, if the Soviet Union is gone, why do we need about 90% of these bases? And I disagree with David on another point here. It's not a great disagreement, but you do need the Congress, because they will marshal themselves against you, like John Murtha from Pennsylvania did, and Sam Nunn from Georgia did against us, if you are looking at a particular overseas base that they like. You really got to get them on your side, and you got to get them forcefully on your side in some respects. I especially think it would be that way in the Middle East. When we looked at this, we talked to foreign ministers and counterparts to Powell all across the world, from Australia to China, to Canada, Mexico. We said things like, okay, why do we have this base? Why do we have that base? Why should we do this? Why should we do that? In those conversations, we discovered that there were some people who were very concerned about our closing of base. One of the particular countries in that regard was Australia. And the foreign minister of Australia at the time put it this way to Powell. He said, I have a lot more faith if a U.S. soldier is on the ground in, or Marine, take your pick, on the ground in Australia than I do if I see a carrier swinging a mooring buoy off Perth. And Powell's argument at that time was very persuasive. The carrier swinging at the mooring buoy was a hell of a lot more powerful than a bunch of Marines or soldiers on the ground in Australia. But we understood what the foreign minister was saying. And so we wound up with a very small group of bases that we would retain. And the criteria were something like this. One, essential to any strategic approach to a contemplated threat in that area. And here's the one that was really smart, I thought. A friendly population around the base. That really limited our base structure. And we were hell-bent to go down to that. And of course, we were doing the domestic backgrounds too at the same time. Where we got derailed, let me read you this. The one constant in recent U.S. foreign policy, regardless of which party occupies the White House, is that it prioritizes military intervention over all other instruments of national power. While President Barack Obama vowed to move the U.S. away from its, quote, perpetual wartime footing, unquote, by the end of his presidency, he had overseen the bombing of seven countries and had greatly expanded the drone war. In the last full year in office, the U.S. military dropped 26,171 bombs on seven countries, an average of 71 bombs per day. Let me conclude by saying I was invited to the White House to meet with President Obama in November of 2015, the last year of his second term. We were supposed to spend about 15 minutes with him, Major General Paul Eaton and myself. He was thanking us for helping him get a very difficult joint comprehensive plan of action, nuclear agreement with Iran, essentially through a very difficult Congress. We spent 45 minutes with him, and the 45 minutes were taken up by the president giving us a disquisition. The very opening sentence will live in my mind forever. Quote, there is a bias in this town toward war, unquote.
And the next 40 minutes plus were spent telling us that he had no idea what to do about it. But one of the things we could do about it is to begin to close this overseas base structure, which costs so much, facilitates war, and makes us think that everybody in the world is our enemy.
Very much, Colonel Wilkerson, and thank you for all our fantastic speakers. Now we have time for questions. I can't really, couldn't have even imagined that each of you have complimented each other so well. So we want to thank all our fantastic speakers. So questions both in the room and from the live stream.
Well, I'd just like to remember the president of Ecuador who closed a U.S. base, and I think he said that the United States can keep a military base in Ecuador as long as Ecuador gets to have a base in Florida. And so the United States had to move out, and we're, you know, hoping that would continue. Other countries will say goodbye. Other things that I'd like to say, you know, people have been announcing working on this for 15 years, maybe longer. How do we deny those in power the ability to do these things? War. There are two things that I think of. Not from the Catholic worker, right? Denying the soldiers, trying to get young people not to join the United States military. That's one thing. And the other is that we all have to be touched in our heart that we have to pay the tax dollars that are used to do all of this stuff. I'd love to hear all of us say, we'll put our money in diplomacy or whatever. We're going to tell these war makers that we're not going to do it. And finally, I hold a sign at the Pentagon for years. 9/11 was an inside job to lead to war. So I'd like to say, I'd love to talk to you about it. I hear what you're saying about Saddam Hussein or Osama bin Laden. But I have a different take on it.
Other questions?
I'll throw one out. My name is Pat Elder. I work with World Beyond War, and I have been studying lately.
Maybe one or more of our speakers would like to address the environmental damage caused by overseas bases in particular. Kathy, I know that's been part of your work.
The island of Guam is a Superfund site.
One second. Mm-hmm. Saying it lost the audio. Okay, good. Try again, Kathy.
Okay. Yes. Hi. In terms of the environmental impact of bases, it's quite extensive. On the island of Guam, you have in your packet, the website has the image of the third of the island of Guam, which is in military basing. but a much larger swath of the island has been impacted by U.S. Military presence in terms of toxic deposits in the soil, contaminated water, depletion of or salinization as a result of the overuse of the water supply on Guam by a population that the island at this point can no longer support, even as more Marines are coming from Okinawa. So that that the island of Guam is a Superfund site has a lot to do with the fact that overseas bases are often treated somewhat differently from domestic bases in terms of their compliance with environmental protections. But the heavy industrial operations of the contemporary U.S. military are often involve various kinds of cancer-causing, birth defect-causing chemicals, which when they make their way into water supplies and soil and air are, again, deeply damaging to local populations. Guam is a Superfund site, still not cleaned up 25 years after it was so declared. So I think that's a very important consideration. As we withdraw from these bases, our responsibility to clean up behind us, as we did not do in the Philippines or in South Korea when we moved bases or left. And I think that's a real, again, moral stain on the United States as well that we have to consider when we look at what these 800 bases and including the wartime bases where environmental protection goes completely out of the window. And I think that's a significant part of the problem that we're trying to solve.
Got another question here. Whoever was first.
I think the most important issue here with the American people, with the Congress, with others, is fiscal. I know the other humanitarian concerns are close in March, but it's probably the fiscal matter that's going to be the one that gets changed. As the last answer being given, we encountered contemplating closing bases to both foreign governments on whose territory some of the bases were, and with the Congress with regard to exactly what was said. The cleanup costs are astronomical. In some cases, we've been there, as in Korea, for half a century to dump JP-4, JP-5, JP-8, aviation fuel, of other, all kinds of stuff. Cleaning these places up. I can remember Bill Powell's book when he gave an estimate of what it would be just in a couple of countries. It's astronomical. So when you start talking about the dollars associated with the dollars associated with energy, I think that's where you get to know. We can't keep doing this. We are going to have, in less than a decade, interest payments on our debt. You can say good business, Congress does all the time. You can say, I don't worry about the deficit. Or Dick Cheney says, oh, waiting through deficits don't matter, blah, blah, blah. I think they do matter, but you can get away with saying that the overall deficit. You got to make those payments every day, or you default. The CBO just released a report that said the defense budget, now $716 billion, and the payments on the debt are going to equal each other within a decade. That means no discretionary federal spending left. You have no budget because you're spending it all on interest payments on the debt, on your military, which is extraordinarily expensive now, shouldn't be, and on entitlements. So you have no money left. If we
all do something about that, we're in serious, serious trouble. So I think that's the angle of attack that resonates most.
Colonel Wilkerson, we got a question from online that I think links into that, and maybe you could just address it briefly. Someone asked, are there particular members of Congress that we should target to get on our side to avoid the kind of opposition you're talking about?
That's a difficult question to answer now. You see what the House can do for money, House, looks like after the installation of the economy. But I know there are a lot of bets in that. I've fought for a lot of those bets, both Republican and Democrat. I know they're very concerned about two things. Physical situation in a constant war. And they want to put a stop to both. And so I think there is a possible ally in this new group coming into the House. And there are senators. I talked to Joe Manchin recently about the Yemen war. Tim Kaine in Virginia about the Yemen war. Mike Lee from Utah. You may have seen Mike Lee has been Bernie Sanders' greatest partner. Again, this issue of war unifies all kinds of people, progressives, conservatives, liberals, you know, whatever you want to call them, everyone is sick and tired of this interminable war, as you pointed out so well. This is incredible what we're doing. It's awesome what we're doing. We look like Rome times 10, and we look like Rome times 10 about the time of Nero. This is not good. This is not good at all. So there are people who are beginning to understand this, and if you saw in that boat yesterday, if you can get the herd moving, that's hard. But if you get the herd moving, you can go to the garden.
Thank you. I know Christine Ahn may have to leave us momentarily. So Christine, if you do, we thank you and appreciate your time and effort. I know there's at least one more question here.
I'm familiar with the fact that the military personnel themselves feel so powerless. I mean, there's an awakening of the military as it relates to the injury to them as part of the military, not only mental injury, but also from the contaminants on the base. There are sacrifice zones placed in many parts of the United States. I mean, I don't know if they're all identified with signs around them, but I know that they exist. But now the military personnel are coming out with, look what has happened to my, look at the stillbirths, look at the contaminants that have injured my body and my family's bodies. And then they're turning these bases over to regular people in those areas where they're closing them. I mean, they're closing some bases in the competition rates, just as we're talking about here in the world. So, is there a law against military personnel getting their needs met when they're injured so badly from the environmental conditions from the bases in the United States? And if so, can that be expanded then to the people, the victims in these other countries? And what can we do to bring to light what is happening to people on the bases and in the United States and in the world?
Maybe I'll take one more question, and then because we're running out of time, perhaps our speakers could offer a few final thoughts, including about strategy moving forward.
I
So a couple questions, one about Okinawa, and which also I think relates to policy and strategy choices moving forward, including the question of where to begin. Is Okinawa the place to begin? Do we begin elsewhere? So
let me address the Okinawa question. When I was in the Marine Corps,
David, could we can't hear.
And to see if it was a viable thing. Well, the first conclusion we came to was that maybe with the movie The Princess Bride, no one's going to start a land war. Certainly not the United States with respect to China. So why do we have land forces that are oriented towards China are so insignificant so far in the world? Well, we came up with a reason that the Marine Corps. Because the headquarters of the Marine Corps fears that if they bring those units home, they'll be stood down. That is to say, the Marine Corps would lose them. Second reason was because they felt their cost calculation showed them that but it was considerably less expensive to have the Marine Corps power than to perform the state they contemplated to come. Has nothing to do with strategy, nothing to do with war plans, and everything. Money, president.
I'll just
probably still does.
Just quickly say that there's been some questions about what we do when we start. There's another question about politics of this. I think we actually do see an emerging left-right coalition in Congress. Bernie Sanders obviously is working on how we find policy broke on that. Democrat from California is also good on this. On the Republican side, you have libertarian Republicans like Rand Paul and Mike Lee, Justin Amash, Massey. There are already elected that dissent from the status quo picture of the one Paul. And so those are the things. There's an interesting tactical question about funding low-hanging fruit. So if you talk to a lot of academics, experts on this, they'll say Europe is a good testing regional study. A lot of the governments are similar to us in terms of values. It's a good safe arena in terms of your aging market. Countries involved are rich and powerful markets themselves against the minor set of trade, et cetera, so Europe is a good thing. But Trump has also made the opportunity. He is sort of a hard nut to crack sometimes. He's a militarist, definitely. He's also highly attuned to cost and doesn't know much about performance, so he wants to. He has questioned advisors the value of having a U.S. He's then no doubt at least. And you have the possibility that it's a kind of grand bargain operation regime, one concession, one character, not the really computerized spontaneous audience. This is a really good idea. They don't serve the purpose of the US security interests. They probably have that made North Korea feel more condemned and actually benefited big companies. So, Pyongyang, so those kinds of things can pop up. These moments where this is actually an issue.
And Kathy.
Yeah, I'm afraid I'm having trouble hearing David, so I can't really comment on anything that was just said. I couldn't hear.
Oh, I'm sorry. Any final thoughts about strategy or any priorities moving forward would be very helpful. And any final thoughts you'd like to offer?
Well, I'm co-director of a project called Costs of War. And we have, over the last 8 years, been working to educate the public about the consequences of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. And in doing that work, I've noticed that the attention that our expert reports get on the body count, on things like the environmental impact, impact on contractors who are often, again, not treated with nearly the amount of care and respect as our veterans. We don't get attention to those papers or media stories as nearly as much as we do to the figure that we come out with annually on the total budgetary cost to the federal government, which earlier this month, we were on Capitol Hill talking about our new $5.9 trillion figure. That wakes people up and gets attention, and it's unfortunate that that's the case, but I think that is strategically an important part of what we're doing is talking about, as Colonel Wilkinson said, trying to survive as a nation, which is increasingly indebted as a result of these very expensive military ventures over many decades, and trying to pare that back and financially, budgetarily, I think is the argument that we need to work with to start.
Thank you, Dr. Lutz. Thank you to all our speakers. We have run out of our allotted time, but I am incredibly encouraged by our gathering today. I encourage everyone to join us, both those here in the room and those viewing online. Please do join us, get in touch. Check out our website where you can find out how to contact us, overseasbases.net, overseasbases.net. And please join us in this very important, as our speakers have shown us, very important struggle and effort to push the administration to begin closing bases overseas in the interest of both protecting national security, international security, and saving billions of dollars in the process that can go to pressing domestic and worldwide needs. Thank you all.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.